This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I borrow your. After a tasty breakfast with my friends this morning, I opened the door and stepped out of the confines of civilization right into nature. The fresh air cooled my face. I found myself standing entirely still. Not a trace of restlessness came up. My breath came easily. Right away, I spotted a single bantail pigeon already sitting at the top of a tall tree. What a zendo, eh? She invited me to join her, so here we are in Zazen. The great gray sky is dripping an infinitude of misty droplets. Everything glistens with water. Then a large flock of bantails swoops down in a wide arc and settles into another tall tree. It's so invigorating to be sitting with bantails. I feel so much love. I am aware of the entire universe sitting with us. This is the holy valley of Jikoji. When we walk, we may feel the mountains walking with us. In this unspoiled space, we may hear the important question, what is most important in life? Okay, this wearing of glasses is something that, you know, it brings something home to me. You know, it was 50 years ago this month that Coben did not, maybe I pass this around. This is a picture of when I was going into,
we're still right here.
When I was going into 5 years of retreat in the Mojave Desert with a nun, Mike Newhall gave me this. He said, do you have a picture of Coben? And he gave me this one to take with me. So this has been sitting on my altar since that day. And the thing I wanted to start with is about this important question business. Well, it's the feeling of 100 years passed by in the twinkling of an eye. You know, we think we're going to have lots of time to complete Buddha's practice here. But, you know, this in 50 years ago now, Coben had no driver's license. And so I was often his chauffeur. You know, I drove him over to Santa Cruz when he was starting the Santa Cruz Zendo. And I drove him, you know, all around. And I was a teacher of his elder child at the Stanford Children's Center. So we're driving down Foothill Expressway in Los Altos. And Coben, he looks at me, and he's got almost tears in his eyes. He says, I'm afraid that I'm not going to have enough time to complete my 25-year, project in America. And I said, Coben, you'll have lots of time. Don't worry. And he got, it was about as close as he ever came to getting angry at me. You know, he said, no, we don't have enough time like this. It's running out now. I mean, we're sitting in a small car. He's yelling at me. You know, so I'm talking about, I'm sorry if I scared you. I didn't mean to do that. It just came out. You know, I just, this important thing, you know, like there's all kinds of I can speak from experience, you know, because I'm older. You know, I've wasted a lot of time in my life and you know, without Coben and teaching of the Buddha and all of my friends in the Sangha, I certainly would not be here. I'd be dead or in the joint or something like that. You know, taking refuge in the Sangha, taking refuge in the Buddha, in the awakening mind, taking refuge in kindness. Coben said to me, I said to Coben, I can very often know what you're going to say to me before you say it. And he said, that's a very good quality of you, which can be developed. So I trust my teacher, Coben, because this business about being able to understand these kinds of things, well, it happens a lot. I have a friend in the next room, and she can't walk, but when I asked her this question, what is most important in life, she replied, without having to think about it, love. This is the American Sign Language sign for love. Would you please bring her in? She can't walk. You too? This is Coco, the gorilla. She was my very close friend. And this is the manufacturer that made this effigy. Came and said, we want to do it so it is completely exact, and that we measured her, all of her fingers, her toes, her nipples, which you can see here, you know, all of the different things. She weighed 200 pounds the last time I saw her. And 3 days before she passed, I said, Coco, I'm having an intuition that you're going to pass in 3 days. Do you have this intuition also? And she said, yes. And at that time, I asked her what is most important in life. And she said, love. And this was Coco's great teaching to everybody, you know, that she was always concerned about the planet. You know, she said, you know, we need to put love on the planet. We don't want to go and put, you know, hatred and anger and greed and all this kind of thing. And, you know, this is kind of an interesting thing because, you know, she is a gorilla. So at the time, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, she was a kind of a household word in America. I don't know do all of you know who Coco was?
Yes.
You know, because, you know, that she was on the cover of the National Geographic magazine, and she was very fond of taking selfies long before they were popular. So we're working with the Smithsonian right now to bring some of her things there. They want to make an exhibit of Coco's things. And so I just looked around and found some. Here's a big picture of Coco. This is one of my favorite ones that you know, this is the thing about Coco that is so. The Gorilla Foundation is the bottom line of it is interspecies communication. That we need to understand the other animals in our world, and then we won't be harming them. And so Coco was a great leader of that. She especially liked snakes. And so whenever I would go, you know, like two times a week, I would spend the morning with her for several years. And we always start, I'd be preparing her meal in the kitchen, and I would, when she was ready, she'd say, whoo, from her trailer, which was just across the yard. And then I'd know that it was time to go for a visit. So I'd drop what I was doing and zoom over there to see Coco and sit down in front of her. And we'd sit, you know, about half the distance from me to Doug. And the first thing we would do was Zazen. Now, this is an interesting thing because, you know, like Coben said to me, he said, there's several ways that you can do Zazen. You know, traditionally you do it facing the wall. You know, he told me with your wife, you can do it sitting and facing her if you want to. But Coco, the interesting thing was that she loved to sit facing me and she would never blink her eyes. I mean, like we'd sit for 15 minutes or half an hour maybe, you know, just this far apart, and our eyes would be right into each other's eyes. And there would be no blinking. Now, you know, to try to do that with a human being, you know, that's not, you know, our minds are always kind of blink, blink, you know. Or, you know, sometimes I'd play with Coco and say, blink, blink, and she'd say, blink, blink. But she liked to do, she was very funny, and she had a humor that, you know, she and I shared it. She, for example, she invented her own sign language. I mean, she knew, you know, hundreds and hundreds of signs, and she could talk to Penny or Ron, you know, using them. You know, I know a few things, but she invented a very good one, because one of the things that she liked to do with me is play chase. You know, that you know, she would touch her wrist right here, time for chase, and then I would speed out the door of her place and go around to the other side, come in from the other side of her house, and she would speed across from the inside to meet me, and we'd get there both panting and laughing and happy. But sometimes she would do the thing for chase, and then I'd tear out the door and go around the other side, and I'd get there, and she'd just be sitting where she'd been sitting before with a smile. Trick you. So it was just really really fun. So this weekend we've been having a nature session up here, and We've gone and visited the skull of a mountain lion that lives up in the forest at a spring that has sweet water all year. And we caught some newts, and we just enjoyed being in the forest. And we went down and visited the site of an Indian village that has been occupied for 15,000 years. And so during the time of sitting yesterday, now normally that's my sitting bench in the back corner there in the usual teacher's seat. And but I pushed myself a little bit in my sitting. Sit for several hours before the wake up bell, and when I was 20, you'd get a little bit of pain in your knees, and you'd just say, well, I have a little bit of pain in my knees, I'll just sit with it, and then when I finish sitting, then I'll walk around, it'll be fine again. But yesterday I pushed myself, and it hurt my knee. And so it's just like, suddenly at this age you realize, next month on Buddha's birthday I'm going to be 74. So it's a, I'm kind of have a sense of running out of time in my life. And you have to address things. I asked Coco one time, "Are you afraid of dying?" And she just laughed. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because on the day that she passed, I was cooking, and then Penny came in to me, the director of the Gorilla Foundation, and she said, "Coco just passed. Would you come and talk to us?" And so we picked up Coco, just like this, Anthony and I, and we carried her in. Lay her on a blanket, and dragged her across the floor, and set her up in her bedroom, and then we called all the caregivers that were around, and we all were in the room together, and everybody was just sobbing, men and women. Everybody was just sobbing. When you were with Coco, you had a kind of a friendship. A relationship that was, something that is very long lasting. And then Coco's right in front of me, and I'm holding her hand, this hand right here. And I said, "Coco, I know what your lips are like when we kiss when you're alive, but I want to find out what they're like when you're not alive." So I leaned forward and just gave her a peck on the lips, and her lips were the same. They were kind of, she just passed away. And so, it was just kind of an interesting experiment. And then everybody's wailing around here, and they're kind of looking at me. And then Coco, big as life, she appeared right up here in the room, and she said, "Tell them funny stories about things you and I did together." And it was just such a blessing to have her say that to me, because then I started to just, reminisce about funny things that we did, I'd say, "Coco, open your mouth. I want to see inside your mouth." And I'd peer inside of her mouth like this, and I'd say, "Oh, I can see out the other side." And she'd laugh. She always got jokes, and it was just, and she loved holes. So whenever there was a hole, she was very interested in my fillings, I'd go out in the woods and I'd find a rock that had a hole in it, and I'd show it to her, and she'd be very interested in it. Holes and snakes were two of her favorite things. And so I told these stories to everybody. We're all sitting there in the room, and then pretty soon everybody's cracking up laughing. It's just like Coco knew what to do, and she said it to me, and through that, this sense of humor, and through Coco's kind love, she's when after she passed, especially, she was just beaming with love. I mean, it was like she was a light bulb of love, just shining. It was just so wonderful. And then that same day, after everybody had settled down, then I was walking one of the other volunteers out to her car, and we passed Ndume's. He was out in the big yard, and he. Someday we'll have to go up to the Gorilla Foundation and we can do Dazen inside the big yard or something like that. It might be a fun thing to do on one of these nature sessions or something. And Dume was agitated. Now, he was a big male, so he was twice the size of Coco. And he weighed like 400 pounds to her, too. And he was just obviously pacing around and unhappy. And so Coco said to me, in my mind, she said, go over to Ndume and tell him that if he wants to find me, I'm on the tip of every leaf on every tree and every forest in the whole wide world. And I went over to Ndume and stood next to him, and he came over and he stood right in front of me, and I told him that, and he relaxed. You know, his shoulders went down. My shoulders are a little bit tense sometimes. When I'm doing yoga, I have to kind of remember, oh, but let your shoulders relax, Eric, or when I'm sitting. But, you know, Ndume, he just relaxed in this kind of a way. So it was very interesting to see that Coco knew about these kinds of things. And we have at the Gorilla Foundation every Friday a Power of Eight meditation. Eight of us get together and we work for the world, and we work for people in our lives who are in need of help, you know, physically, you know, including animals. Very often, one or more of us feel the presence of Coco with us. And, you know, that she said that, you know, she's present, you know, is something that's so strong. When I unveiled this, I drove Coco over here this morning in my truck, and nobody looked at me and said anything. We put Coco, you know, like this Coco inside the front seat of the car and drove around through Palo Alto and everything like this. And it went down University Avenue, and, you know, there people are all going by, and nobody, I mean, they were like, really quite hilarious. You know, and Penny told me that when Coco was younger, that she used to ride with two gorillas in her car and, you know, ride around in Palo Alto, and everybody would always quickly look away and what lady with a gorilla in her car? But anyway, at Stanford in those days in the 70s, you know, like I was a teacher at the Stanford Children's Center at that time, and you know, I would have my students go out, we'd take walks around campus go swimming in a fountain at White Plaza and stuff like that. You know, what can I do? I've got a bunch of little kids with me. They can't bust me. You know, so, but we would often see Penny or one of the other people who worked there at that time, when Coco was very small, you know, she'd be riding in a child's bike seat on the back of the bicycle, going around campus, a gorilla. So it's just, I feel so supported in my life by Coco and by Coben. One time he said he liked gorillas and he liked Coco, and he said to one of his another priest, he said, I would like to be a gorilla swinging around in the tops of the trees, and when I would see somebody down on the ground who needed help, I would swing down and help them. Isn't that a nice image, being a Coben as a gorilla swinging down out of the trees and just going over to help somebody? Ross asked me a question before we started on this that I think is important. When we chant the sutra on knowing the better way to live alone, Buddha, in the God of the Forest Hot Springs Sutra, the Buddha said about this particular sutra, the Knowing the Better Way to Live Alone Sutra, he said, this contains the deepest meaning of my teaching. You should recite it and memorize it regularly. So the sutra, you know, at first it talks about don't pursue the past. And then it says, do not lose yourself in the future. I mean, you can, you know, getting lost in and is different than just, you know, you may think about, well, I have to get gas in my car before I go home, or else I may run out of gas on the highway. Guess I'm talking to myself. But looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, I mean, we're talking about not looking at the past. In a sense, the image that Buddha is giving us here about what to do is he's saying the present. He's trying to point to, I think, the present, which is a pinprick. He's talking about life, actual vivid life, I think, and that if you're looking at other things, if you're distracted by other things like this, you've got a lot on your mind, if you've got, you know, that you need to have time. And that's what Jikoji is for, I think, is to come and have a practice for this. We can go out into nature and we kind of lose all those trappings of civilization and we can just be with a tree. So this, so, and the sutra says that we must be diligent today. To wait until tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? Well, I remember Angie would invite me sometimes to come down and hear her talk and sit with her at the Quaker Meeting House and. Down in town, and one time I came in and everybody was chanting the Heart Sutra one time after another, walking around in a circle, and there was a picture of Koban on a table, and it was the day that Koban had passed, and it was so I was just so shocked, you know, because you know Koban was 10 years older than I was, I mean, I just never thought of him passing. You know, he seemed like, you know, like he would, he, you know, people would try to call him Roshi, you know, old master, and he would say, "I'm not old," and you know, and he liked to play, and you know, and so suddenly, all of a sudden, he's gone, and that really, this sutra really was, you know, came to me about that. You know, it said, you know, you think you've got all this time in the world. You know, it's just like the other day, I was coming over to Jikoji. From where I live at the Gorilla Foundation up in Woodside. And I saw flashing lights, emergency lights. And I had been parked over at this place where this incredible tree that I found is, we at the Nature Session went and visited it yesterday. It's just a magnificent old tree. I hope you can all go with me there sometime. I was parked there and this man came by on a bicycle. And it was a bright red bicycle, and we waved at each other. And he continued on. He went up the hill, and you know, I was hanging out with the tree, and you know. And then, as I'm driving over here, there's a red bicycle on the side of the road, and I thought, oh boy. And you know, in the glove compartment of my car. I carry pictures of Coco, you know, the Gorilla Foundation calendars and many pictures. And this man was, you know, he was obviously, you know, he was almost dead. And I went up to him and I held this picture right in front of his face. And he smiled and he passed away. I mean, it's like, you know, when you see this a bicyclist going along the road, you know, and you wave at him, you know, and I mean, who would have thought that he was that in half an hour he was going to be killed on the road like that? It's just, you know, and, you know, where I live at the Gorilla Foundation, you know, they people come up the straightaway from Alice's restaurant. And there was this one, you know, there are a lot of beautiful cars that go through there. And this one day I saw this, you know, it was just a beautiful Maserati. It was brand new and sparkling and shiny and everything like that. And it must have been going 100 miles an hour. And later on that day, I was coming from there over here, and here's that Maserati upside down on the side of the road by Crazy Pete's Road. You know, so I'm just, you know, this thinking about, I'm sorry about this. I guess I'm just feeling, asking the question of myself, you know, what's important today? You know? You know, you never know. You know, it was, and even when, like my wife, and when we were on retreat, you know, we lived in a little tough shed, 10 by 12 tough shed, you know, with no neighbors within 5 miles. And we would get up at midnight and she would read aloud. It's a Tibetan Buddhist practice, a nun practice that she was familiar with, read sutras aloud. One person, she said, "I'm going to be the teacher right now. Koban told you to make me your teacher. You're going to go along with me also. I'm going to leave you and go to Zen Center." So we had this very strict practice going on. And 5 years before, she became very clairvoyant during this time of, you know, not being, we didn't have any interaction with other people. And you know, it was very quiet out there in the high desert, you know, and you know, you can see 100 miles across to Joshua Tree Park. And, you know, it's just, you know, you can see the sun come up 100 miles away over the mountaintop. And she said to me that morning, she said, "I am going to pass away on the 1st of October, 2015. What? And, you know, and then from time to time, as the time went by, you know, she would say, October 1st, Eric, you're going to finish up what you have things to do here. You're going to get yourself together. You're going to be, or you're just going to go running around and being some scientist. You know, and she said, when we're on retreat here in the desert, you are not a husband. You are no longer a bright light of the open space district, getting the millions and millions of dollars for their land by finding rare things. You are just yourself. You know, you can't be anything else but yourself. And she was very strict about this. If I would, you know, bring up, you know, she said, you are not going to get involved in any Save the Desert campaigns. I mean, they would come and ask me if I would help them with it. And you know, but she was very strict about that. And I think we have an opportunity, having a place like Jikoji, to really try and find out what is the Buddha's teaching. You know, the Buddha's teaching, to me, is all about love. You know, the Buddha had a nice way of explaining this. He would say, enlightenment can be found in four abodes, four places. You know, love, compassion, equanimity, and joy. So as we live our lives, you know, we can practice the Buddha's way by remembering, you know, are we acting in a loving way? Are we being compassionate to other people and thinking of other people or just ourselves? Do we have a sense of calmness in the face of somebody comes up to us and, you know, and a woman who had been in prison, she came up to me and with her fist like this, a woman that I know, and she came up to my face and she said, you hit me first. You know, it's kind of a way, when you're dealing with courts and things like that, you know, you have to be able to say, she hit me first, he hit me first, you know, and I didn't start this fight, he started it, she started it. Something like that. So we have to, equanimity means that in the face of something like that, you know, some adversity that comes to us like that, you know, we can return to a sense of equanimity, to of calmness and tranquility. There is a, I'm so happy today. I love being able to be here. There's a place over in the San Joaquin Valley, it's the town of Tranquility. And when I was working for the University of Texas as an archaeologist, I was finding Indian rock painting sites in the desert. And I visited this, and at that time, a new archaeological site had been found at the town of Tranquility, and I visited the town of Tranquility to see the site. And it was out here in the midst of these vast plains, and there was just nothing. You know, you go out walking and through there, and there are horned lizards running out of the way as you came along, and the San Joaquin River has a tributary that's right there. And here's this 15,000-year-old archaeological site. They're getting things out of the ground that are 15,000 years old, you know, mammoth kinds of things. You know, and the site was just so wonderful and tranquil. Whenever I think of the word tranquility, I think of, you know, that, you know, what the experience of that is. You know, here at Jikoji, you know, you can walk off in the forest, you know, go off the trail someplace, you know, you don't have to go far. And, you know, there's, you know, maybe you wander up towards Pear Tree Spring up there, you know, like up on the hillside above Pear Tree Spring is the historical site of an Indian sweat lodge, you know, and they're just, you know, there's a village down here where Indians lived for many, many years, and maybe you'll find pieces of flaked rock and things that the Indians used, and you feel presences. Sometimes you start going towards this Indian site down here. If you walk down there today, you know, the open space has just put red do not enter tape across there, so, you know, to protect the site so nobody drives on the site and chews it up with their vehicles. And you can, you know, be a little bit felonious and go into the place that says do not enter and feel it, you know, just kind of hang out there a little bit, you know, like there's I feel like I can talk in this kind of a way and not be scoffed at, because Coben would talk to me in this kind of a way. He said, you know, you can go down there and you can feel the presences of Indians who are still living there. You know, you can't see them, but you know they're there and you can, you know, bring them a gift. You know, what's your favorite thing to bring as a, you'd like to have as a gift? Potato chip? I don't know. You know, you could bring something cool thing like that down there to them. Anyway, I'm just trying to express something of a, you know, I'm not really a person who just quotes scripture all that much. I guess that, you know, like for me, Buddhism has become my life, and I just have to, you know, the experiences of my own life, my own daily life, are what is the Dharma. Do you have any questions? Or any comments? Or Ross, it's, I wish I had been able to sit full lotus, you know. I tried and tried and tried, but I just never could get my legs into that position. Look at him over there, sitting like he did. It was the easiest thing in the world. Greg.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sentience. I had this sense in Buddhism.
I know what you're thinking of.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I had that. I have the same feeling.
Then I don't need to ask the question. Just answer it.
Yesterday, Craig and I and the people at the Nature Session, we went to visit a tree. And his question about sentience. You know, if you're in the woods a lot with young children, like I am, as a teacher, you know, and I'm not teaching them, not giving them just tons of information. I'm letting them encounter trees and things like this. And you'll find that sometimes, and the children will sometimes, they go up and maybe they kind of lean against a tree and, you know, put their arm around a little bit, or they, you know, they come up to me and they like one 8-year-old boy came up to me last week and he said, we were up on the top of a mountain in the East Bay and he came up to me and he said, this place is so peaceful. And I felt like as a teacher, I had succeeded. Mm-hmm. I had brought some children out, this boy outside into nature, and he had experienced it. It's like sentience. I think for me, this ancient tree is, I mean, you go stand next to it. You feel its sentience. You feel it. It's not like some vague life idea or something like that. It's not a life. It's something, it's vivid life. You know, you can feel, you can, I told the story yesterday about something. Lena went to visit another ancient tree up there, Methuselah. Have you ever visited Methuselah? Do you know this tree? It's an 1,800-year-old redwood that's on the side of Skyline, north of Alice's restaurant, about 2 miles. And it's, you know, it's like 15 feet across or something like this, and it's, you know, hundreds of feet high. And you know, like, and there are several photographs down in the historical archives of Santa Clara County, of San Mateo County, that show a picture of Methuselah standing alone in a barren land, absolutely clear cut, no trees standing. You go there now, and there's hundreds of trees that are 4 feet in diameter. You know, but this tree, and Lena went to this tree when she first came to America from Russia, and she went up to the tree and she kind of put her arms around it like this and she said, what do you know that you have lived so long? And this wave of love just came out of this tree and just washed over Lena, and she just cried and cried. And she said, you know, and it's just, you know, this question of sentience, you know, of, you know, trees, are trees sentient? Do trees have feelings? You know, when you meet one of these really ancient trees, like Methuselah, or like this tree that we found today, I don't know what the name of it is. Maybe we can find a lot together, so all of us, we can find a name. It's a, you know, it's just so obviously sentient. I mean, it's like, you know, you don't have to be an Einstein to, you know, experience of the this tree is living and alive, and then as I started to feel the quality of aliveness of this tree, then all the aliveness, you know, it was like we sat down, we you know, there were 10 of us, I guess, went there yesterday, and we all, after we had, you know, talked about the tree and everything like that, we all began to do zazen. We sat down on the forest floor following his example. He's always, you know, setting a bad example for us. So so we all sat down, and it was just, you know, I was standing next to this tree, and I looked out from this tree. I was leaning against this tree, And I saw Doug sitting there, and I saw everybody kind of take their places, and they found their exact places. And I mean, it was the feeling like everybody is in the place where God put them. I mean, it was just, you know, it was like I had a vision of something that was just so beautiful at that moment to be able to see that. And sometimes when we're in that space of encountering the true vivid sentience of other beings, it was a very moving thing for me. Tears almost came to his eyes yesterday, and you know, it was a very moving experience to do that. You know, I never met the tree side of him. You know, I said we see each other around here around Jokoji, and we talk, and we're friends, and you know, but you know, that being able to share that kind of a thing, you know, being able to share something like with this one, and you know, like this one here, she, you know, I got to thinking, oh, Eric, you have such great supernatural powers. You can close your eyes and walk around the forest at night and you'll never bump into anything. First night, I fell down and banged my head and was just so bloody all around here on my right eye like this. And the next day, it was one of my days to go see Coco. And I went into Coco and her room, and she was sitting about as far away from me in the other side of her room as Ross is from me. And she looked at me and she rushed over sideways. You know, gorillas go sideways. They don't go like we do. So this gorilla came zooming over to me like this and sat down right in front of me. And her face was this close to mine, and she blew kisses onto my face. Oh. And it was just so, that's love. That's compassion. You know, and it's like, it was, when I went in to see her, you know, some of the people took photographs of me at that time. And it was, you know, it was pretty bloody. But by 2 days later, it was completely healed. There was nothing there. Thank you, Coco. So I think of Coco as I guess I sometimes do it with Coben too. I say, Coco, you know, and it's just, you know, it's like, it's a word of, it's like almost like a mantra, kind of like if you have it like that, you can protect the mind. You know, and we can just use it. If you have something like, I don't know, for me, Coco, I mean, everybody has to find their own thing, I guess, but you know, like, before we go into, you know, we will encounter bad situations in our life, you know, scary things or, you know, death, who knows? I don't know. You know, the times when I have been with somebody as they die, there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing to be afraid of. You know, it's like the last words of my wife to me before she passed away was, she said in a voice that was so soft, and I had to lean down to her. It took her 3 hours to say, I want to go home. And she said, I'm going home. You know, and she had this, you know, I was, you know, she had been lying for 5 days, you know, she couldn't get up and go to the bathroom or anything like that. I had to pick her up and carry her, and she couldn't eat anything. And then she would start to she'd say, I'm hungry. Can I eat some paper? Or, you know, things like that. You know, she was clearly on the other side, experiencing the other side. And she would tell me things from the other side, what was happening there. And, you know, it helped me very much because people seem to know that I am aware of that space. And they come to me, you know, my friend who's a motorcycle racer who lives here in Saratoga, his best friend, a motorcycle racing buddy, was killed in a wreck. And my friend was just very distraught about it. He'd been there. And he came to me and he told me about this. And I could see his friend, and I was able to say, Ken, your friend is in a garden, and there's stones along the side of the path, and he's very happy, and he says, when are you going to come to me, Ken? And it was just, you know, being able to have this kind of an experience of things. It's about sentience. We're talking about a realm of being completely open. You know, the awakening mind is completely open to all kinds of things. You know, we can see. One time I was I was teaching at Stanford Children's Center, and I took my class over to an archaeological site along Los Trancos Creek by Ford Park in Portola Valley, and I was just standing. I had two women who were helping me. We three were just standing aside, and we were watching this group of 8 children playing, and then suddenly one of the children says, "Look at that girl over there. She has no clothes on." And everybody looked over there, and they started laughing, and they were making the usual childhood jokes about seeing a naked person and, you know, playing around there like that. But then you tune into this, and you know, I saw through their eyes what they were seeing. They were seeing some Indian native children naked playing, and after they'd passed, and I mean, it's just interesting that the realms that, you know, Coben would, you know. Our lineage comes from Buddha through Coben. And you know, Coben said to me one time, you know, he said, my teacher is Buddha, and after Buddha is Jesus. So, you know, we're in a lineage which includes both of these teachers. And, you know, that we are entitled as disciples to know what they know. And, you know, we can encounter these kinds of things that they're encountering, that they're being able to help people. With love. That was a roundabout way of talking about your question, Craig, but I hope it opened it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Do you have time for another question?
Yes, sir.
So I grew up in the forest, and I now live again in the forest.
Wonderful.
And it's fantastic, and I've also noticed that I sometimes have fear arise.
Yeah.
Instead of equanimity, we'll see mountain lions on game cams. I used to want to practice yoga outside, and I found myself just not being able to focus. And so now I practice yoga indoors. I don't walk alone at night in the forest, for example. I think a friend of mine told me that you have dealt with this in many ways. You mentioned going out at night, for example, recently. How do you hold that space of being aware that there are creatures that could, you know, enjoy you for a second?
I think my feeling is that is it comes from the media. It comes from other people. That fear of mountain lions. I mean, talking specifically about mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
Mountain lions are my friends, and I encounter them fairly regularly. And one of the ways that I have learned to develop fearlessness is by looking into a lion's eyes. The total lack of fear in a lion's eyes communicates itself, it's contagious, infects my being with fearlessness. You know, and like one time I was walking along, and I had walked past it, just walking. I like to walk by myself, and I was just walking along, and then my peripheral vision picked up that there was a lion over there, and I said to myself, is there a lion over there? I looked over, and there was a lion, you know, like about from the distance from me to you. And you know, so we just stood there together looking at each other, not, you know, this great big lion, 8 feet long, with a tail, big long tail, just looking at each other. You know, I could see from this distance, I could see the whiskers coming out, and you know what they looked like was as they're coming out. You know, I could see the nose. You know, you'd see, and the lion didn't move, and I didn't move. And then finally, I got this feeling of, you know, like I think I'm gonna talk to the lion and see if we can get a little bit closer. And so I just began to speak to the lion. I just, you know, I said, you know, like, you know, I think you're very beautiful and you're very muscular, and you know, and you know. You know, I mean you no harm, and I would like to be able to walk over and see you more closely. And, you know, so then I took a step, and, you know, I kept on just talking about how beautiful it was, and, you know, the curve of her tail, and, you know, and just, you know, like you stand so still. It's really like you're doing Zazen meditation and standing there just like that. And I kept going more and more, and I got quite close to the lion, less than 10 feet. And then the lion just, you know, all right. And it kind of loped off just very, very easily, no problem at all. It didn't have any problem with me. And another time I was, you know, I was walking along the woods, and I heard this great commotion up in the forest in front of me. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get to see some wild boar and bother them. So, you know, I went ahead quickly, and the creek was a little bit overgrown right there where the sound came from. But finally I found a place that was a little clear spot that was going out over the creek, and I got there, and you know, I stood up, and here I am standing here, 5 feet below my toe, a mountain lion has just killed a deer, and it's looking at me, and I'm looking at it, and in my pocket is what I want. It's called a camera. And I'm trying to fish in my pocket. I'm saying, no, you got that deer all by yourself. The darn camera won't come out of my pocket. You know, I'm fishing here like this, and the mountain lion, you know, he's kind of looking at me, and I'm looking at the mountain lion. No fear is involved. And then the lion starts to inch away, and I finally get the camera out, and then it's speeding away, and I'm speeding after it, and I finally get one picture, and it's just the lion is going into a place that's overgrown. The creek bottom is overgrown. It's like a cave going back in there, and I got a picture of his rear end and his tail just before he disappeared into that thing, and I thought, I'm not going to go in there after that lion. Mm-hmm. But the feeling, and then I went back to the deer that it killed, and it was still warm, you know, and I inspected it very carefully, and there was not one mark on that deer. Do you know that lion jumped on top of that deer, put its arms around its neck, and broke its neck? That power. You know, so when I see these people up there, the signs at open space in the state parks, you know, they say, if attacked, fight back. You know, when you think of the power of a lion, you know, breaking, you know, if you find a roadkill of a deer sometime, you know, feel the muscularity and the strength of the deer's neck. But lions are not, you know, they don't. Fear can be very easily misplaced. When I was a biologist working for grant money for Open Space District here, the state mountain lion hunter became a friend of mine, and he taught me about, you know, all sorts of things about lions. And we talked about the question that you have just brought to me. And he said, there have been more people killed by deer in California in the last 5 years than there have been in the history of California by mountain lions.
Driving.
No, I mean, like, the problem in Yosemite right now is, one of my friends there told me, is that, you know, people feed the deer, okay? And then they have no more food. Or they don't want to share any more of their food with them. And the deer have very pointed spear-like legs, and they go kick. Another one bites the dust. You know, so more people have been killed in the last 5 years by deer, these gentle, harmless creatures around here, than have been killed by mountain lions in the whole history of California. Mm. You know, so it's just like, I mean, it's a thing of, like the other day I saw something, it was a billboard in East San Jose, and it said, you know, it was about something about COVID. Get tested. Mm-hmm. You know. Oh, no, it was about cigarette smoking. And said, you know, you stopped smoking, get tested. You know, and then for several days I thought, well, a number of years ago I stopped smoking. You know, do I have sickness inside me or anything like that? And you see the mental contagion of something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the same way about lions. We hear all these things about people being, you know, lions being dangerous. And of course, open space has to... You know, down at the Bacchetti Ranch by Stevens Creek Reservoir, there was a family walking along, and the mountain lion picked up a child, and the mother of the child was furious and attacked the mountain lion and drove it off. And, you know, so there's, you know, lions do all of their killing in particular places. You know, there's a place where we went yesterday, a lion kill zone. I found a number of times where lions have killed deer down in there. And, you know, but if you're out in the open, lions don't go out in the open. You know, I mean, they don't, that's not where they do their hunting. If you study the places where lions can, you know, I think about recently, I found a wild boar that had been killed by a mountain lion. Steep-sided gully. This place where we were yesterday, steep-sided gully at a spring. Mm-hmm. You know, another time I was hiking in the woods and there, I was going to this particular spring When I got there, I found that I had disturbed, you know, when we walk through the woods, we disturb deer run away from us, wild animals run away from us, and then the lion gets them. But when I got to this spring, a lion had just killed a deer, was still bleeding, and it had used its nibbles. Lions, they don't, you know, not like wolves and coyotes and dogs, they nibble. And it had nibbled a little hole in the back above the heart, and then I disturbed it. That ran away, you know, but they're very fastidious in their eating habits. So they're not, you know, I'm just trying to talk about, you know, make a real picture of mountain lions for you. I did one time have a problem with a lion. I got very bloody. The thing was that I was walking and I found four newborn lion cubs And I looked at them and I was just, my heart melted and I thought, oh, I just have to pick one up. You know? And I picked it up and my hands were just scratched bloody. And, you know, so I put the lion back down. But anyway, that was not an adult lion. It was just a baby one. So I think, you know, lions are, I mean, when I meet lions, I guess the, what I feel is their beauty and grace. I mean it's like looking at somebody who's the best dancer in the world, best bit of Nureyev or somebody like that. You know, you watch them move and it's just like their body flows like water. You know, it's just, lions are just so gorgeous. You know, hopefully you get to see one time. And you know, here's an example of a local thing, you know, right here at Jokoji that happened a couple of years ago. Lena was in, had a tent camped out over there, and she had some fresh cooked tilapia inside of her tent, and she was on an evening walk. And she got back towards her tent, and she left it open, and there was a mountain lion with its head inside of her tent, you know, probably smelled the fresh tilapia and was like, oh, this is for me. And you just have to, you know, and then Lena said, you know, well, I guess I better kind of go back the way I came. And so she slowly retraced her steps. And when she came back 10 or 15 minutes later, the lion was gone. So, or like, for example, Coben's daughter, Yoshiko, you know, her husband was up on the ridge at the place where we like to go and watch the sun go down. And he was driving back down on Ward Road here, and he looked up into the woods and there's a mountain lion, and he exclaimed to Yoshiko, a mountain lion, I've never seen one before, they're so beautiful. You know, so they're kind of not uncommon in the woods around here. There are several places I know there where Ward Road that you came in on, the road from Skyline, goes down and then it comes to a lock gate up there, and you go through the lock gate, around the lock gate, and then the road crosses over the creek, and immediately on the other side, there used to be a building there when the Pacific High School was here, and where the children painted, and there's a game trail you can see coming down from the right hand side down the slope, and you see, and the lion pretty regularly goes there and makes scrapes, and you know, with its two hind feet, and so almost every day I go by there and just look at it, and you know, see the lion go by last night. You know, so it's just, you know, an appreciation of lions and you know, that they're actually wonderful and peaceful friends of ours here at Jokoji.
Thank you for saying that.
Well, I hope you get back to doing your yoga outside in the woods. I don't think that you'll have a problem with that, with those lions. You can also talk to lions too. They're, you know, you know that lions are kind of interested in people. I think they. Oh, I hear a bell. Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Yes! Oh, I meant to show you one more thing.
Okay.
This is Coco's big hand, and in her room, three green tree frogs lived, just tiny little frogs, and she was very protective of them. And wow. And when Ndume would, you know, she would, when he was around, she would take the tree frog and she'd carry it over to some other place in her room or outside and hide it so he wouldn't find it. She was afraid that he would eat it or hurt it or something.
So this is a color photo. Can you show it online here?
Oh.
See the green right there, yeah. Look at that.
Oh, wow.
Look at Coco's hand.
All right. Well, come on up to the community building for lunch. We'll bow in up there, have announcements. Thank you, everyone.
Can I get a picture, Eric, of you and Coco?
Sure.
There's only many.
Oh, thank you very much.
If you don't mind. With Eric and
he's gonna oh. Oh, Coco's cousin. Coco's cousin.
Sorry.
See, here's Coco's kitten too.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Appreciate it. Ross, right?
Yeah.
That's a great talk.
Wow. Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.